Okay, this is day two in the baby house. The first day we saw Caleb was for about 60 seconds, and it was very quick, kind of tearful, but we're excited. We get to play with him for an hour, so this is our first time to really interact with baby Caleb.
This was our introduction to the reality and the beauty of adoption. We had prayed and wanted and longed for children for about 5 years, and God in His wisdom was not providing in the way we wanted Him to. And so we began to think about adoption. I'm completely honest with myself. In my mind, it was second best, since we can't have our own children, we'll adopt another child. I learned very quickly that was the wrong way to think, that this was best. In the same way that having children biologically is best, this is its best. And so we began the process through which God led us to Kazakhstan to adopt Caleb. We were there for about 5 weeks and came home. 2 weeks after we had gotten home, I came home late one night from a meeting at church, and Heather was still up. She usually goes to bed fairly early, and so I could tell something was wrong that she was still up. She said, "You need to sit down on the couch." I said, "Okay." I said, "What's going on?" She said, "You're not going to believe this, but I am pregnant." Said, "What? How did that happen? I know how. I know how it happened." Apparently, what happens in Kazakhstan doesn't stay in Kazakhstan. I wasn't gonna say that, Dr. Moore, until I heard you say Viagra last night, and so and so I figured it was okay. I hope. And we had been told, as many of you know, throughout the adoption process, not to get your hopes up. You never know when something is going to fall through, and so you guard your heart in many ways to that process. And so, for whatever reason, for 5 years, we had not been able to have children this way. And so, we just decided that night, okay, we're not going to get our hopes up. We don't know if this is really going to play out completely. And so, for the next month, we didn't get our hopes up. Next 2 months, no hopes up. 3 months, 4, 5, 8, 9 months later, hopes still not up, until I came home late one night from another meeting at church, and Heather was awake, and she said, "I'm not feeling good." So we went to sleep. She wakes me up in the middle of the night, cold December night. She wakes me up. She says, "Don't get your hopes up, but I think we need to go to the hospital. I'm not feeling well." She said, "I'm sure it's a false alarm." I said, "Okay, hope's not up." So we drove on that cold December night to the hospital. We got there. It was a bit ironic. When we got there on this cold December night, they told us they didn't have enough room for us. Okay, like, do you have maybe like a manger outside? An innkeeper that I could talk to? And so they stuck us in a closet and hooked Heather up to a bunch of machines in this closet. And we looked groggily at one another for a couple of hours until a lady came in and checked her signs and said, "We need to get you into a room as quick as possible. You're going to have a baby today." And that's when our eyes locked and we decided it was time to get our hopes up. And so So they moved us into this room. Just a little bit about me. I don't do well in hospitals at all. This is not good for me as a pastor, but I don't do well in hospitals at all. I'm getting nauseous right now at the thought of a hospital. So Heather knew this, and a couple weeks before, she had told me that she was praying for me and how I was going to do in this whole process, which, if I can be honest, was a bit of a shot at my pride. Like, my wife is not praying for herself or our child, but for me in the birthing process. And so I was wounded a bit from that. And so we're getting situated in the room, and the nurse is talking with Heather, and the nurse tells Heather that the doctor who's going to deliver the baby actually lets the husband, the father, if he would like to, deliver the baby. Heather starts laughing. Oh, my husband would never do that. Wound number two at the pride. And I decided this was my moment. This was my opportunity to step up. It was one of those times where words start coming out of your mouth and you can't stop them. And I just blurted out, "Well, I'll help deliver the baby." And Heather, with wide eyes, looked over at me and she said, "You will?" I said, "Well, of course. Like, who wouldn't want to deliver a child?" She beamed, smiling. Nurse said, "I'll get things ready." I turn around. I think, what in the world have I done? I am nauseous in this room, and I'm about to deliver a baby. And so I decided I needed a plan. And my plan was, the plan I came up with was, I was going to look at this like it was a mission trip. Okay? Follow with me here. If you've ever been on a mission trip before, you know, you go to another country, you eat things you don't normally eat, you drink things you don't normally drink. And so when you're in Rome, you do what the Romans do. When you're in the hospital, you do what doctors do. Doctors deliver babies. So, besides, I have a doctorate. Granted, it's in preaching, but in the end, it really is all the same. And so it came time. I was psyched up. All right, I'm in another country. It came time. The doctor walks in. He straps a gown on me, some gloves on me, and a mask on me, and for about 60 seconds uses all this medical jargon that I do not understand. He says, "Do you understand?" I said, "Yes, sir." And so he said, "All right, you be standing right behind me when it's time, and I'll tell you what to do." I said, "Okay." So I was standing there. He said, "Okay, it's time." He said, and I'm not going to give you all the details. You obviously don't want all the details. But he says, "All right, reach down. I want you to put your right hand on top of your left hand." It was like Peyton Manning. I've got two nurses flanking me. You right here, you right here. All right, here we go. And all of a sudden, out pops this little head and time stands still. And this baby that we have prayed for years, I pull out and place for my wife's lap while our son waits in the waiting room beside from Kazakhstan. God indeed is sovereign. And I don't know how stories across this room will pan out in the end, but I do know this: God always knows what he's doing. And even that, strangely enough, Heather and I find ourselves at a similar place. We're obviously blessed and content with the two sons that God has entrusted to us. At the same time, there is this longing in us to have more. And for whatever reason, we find ourselves in that situation where God is not providing in the way we had hoped, way we had thought, either physically or even Dr. Moore mentioned that we are in a process of adopting from Nepal. And long story short, this process that started over a year ago, we're wondering if it's really ever going to happen. Do you ever wonder why he gives you that longing? You almost wish he'd take it away. I'm so thankful, Dr. Moore, for the word that you shared last night. Heather and I, listen, that is the strongest word I have heard on the gospel and adoption. And Heather and I were just brought to tears and to our knees. We prayed, "God, we trust you. We trust the gospel. And we're thankful for the gospel and what you..." I have so much to learn. And God is so loving toward us. I want to take you to the book of Ruth with me. If you have a Bible, and I hope you do, go with me to Ruth chapter 2. Ruth is a great love story. Like the Twilight series has nothing on the book of Ruth. All the elements are here. Tragedy, romance, hope, loyalty, triumph. It's all here in this story. And what I love is the dual picture that Ruth gives us. It's multifaceted. We see this picture of loving kindness expressed between a man and a woman. It's a love story between a man and a woman and a mother-in-law thrown in there. She's always there. But it's not just a story about Ruth. It's a story about us. And not just us. It's a story about everyone who finds himself on the pages of history in God's epic story of redemption. And there's so much here on a horizontal level, what it means for us to express love toward one another, and on a vertical level, what it means to receive love from God. And so what I want us to do is I want us to read through chapter 2, verse by verse. The text is so rich, and I want us to just feel it. We miss out the beauty in the original language in this book, and we miss out on some of it in our English translations. And so I want to hopefully help us see and feel the beauty of this story and see some parallels along the way for how this is a reflection even of the love we are talking about when it comes to adoption. And then let that lead us clearly, as the book of Ruth does, to the gospel. So here's the background from Ruth chapter 1. A man named Elimelech and his wife, Naomi, leave Bethlehem in a time of famine, and they go to Moab with their two sons. Upon arriving in Moab, their two sons marry two Moabite women, Orpah and Ruth. Marrying Moabite women was absolutely and utterly shameful. Reason being, history of the Moabites. This is the people that were formed from Lot's incestuous relationship with his daughter. We see a time when Moabite women seduced Israelite men into sexual immorality. And the result was 24,000 Israelites were struck dead. You don't go near Moabite women. They're a forbidden people, a forbidden place. And so, this Israelite family brings two Moabite women into it. Time goes by, and before an heir comes from those marriages, Elimelech and his two sons pass away. And Ruth and Orpah are left barren with a bitter mother-in-law. Naomi decides she wants to go back to Bethlehem. Orpah decides she's going to stay in Moab. And Ruth decides she's sticking with Naomi. And that leads us to the end of chapter 1, where Ruth and Naomi are coming back to Bethlehem empty. Naomi says, "Don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. I'm bitter. I have nothing. I left with everything. I come back with nothing. God has given me nothing." They are two women without family, without food, in desperate need. And at the end, you look right at the end of verse 22, it says they came to Bethlehem, in chapter 1, verse 22, right before chapter 2, it says they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. And there's a shred of hope here. For two women with no family and no food, coming back into Bethlehem in search of family and food at the time of the barley harvest. And they have no clue what is about to happen. And I love this. Side note, I love this in Scripture. Isn't it true that oftentimes God ordains sorrowful tragedy to set the stage for surprising triumph? want to remind you this morning that in the moments where God may seem farthest from you, He may actually be setting the stage for the greatest display of His faithfulness to you. That in the middle of suffering, your God may actually be plotting for your satisfaction. And so they come to the beginning of the barley harvest. And verse 1 in chapter 2 says, Naomi had a relative of her husband, a worthy man of the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. Okay, here's the two women that come into the scene in need of food and family. Boaz is introduced. Two characteristics. Number one, he is from the clan of who? Elimelech. He is family. Clan, a family group that has a responsibility to care for one another. And he is a worthy man, a man of standing, which could be a reference to his character or his wealth, or really, maybe even both together. He is able to provide. So that's the introduction that the author gives us. Now we go into the action. Verse 2. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. Pause here. God had set up a way in Israel for the poor to be provided for. During the harvest, He had instructed for grain to be left in the corners and at different places along the way in order that those who do not have land, do not have food, can come up behind and get some, have some. It wasn't much, but it was better than nothing. And you relied on the favor of someone's field, a harvest in someone's field to benefit you. And so she says, I'm going to go try to find favor somewhere where I can get us some food. And Naomi sends her out, which leads to verse 3. So she set out and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz, who was of the clan of Elimelech. Ha! What a coincidence. And the language here is intentional. It's dramatic. It's like saying, as luck would have it, she just happened among all the fields to go to the exact field where someone from her family, Naomi's family, the clan of Elimelech, owned. She doesn't know that. She just happens to go there. I love this. Brothers and sisters, nothing in our lives happens by accident. Everything is by appointment. You can know that when God is sovereign over every detail in your life. You can know that behind the scenes in every detail of our lives, there is a sovereign God who is always plotting for His people's good and His own glory. And so it just so happens that she comes into Boaz's field. Verse 4. And behold, Boaz. Yes. He just so happens to show up when Ruth is in his field. Like, guys, have you ever been watching a chick flick with your wife? And these circumstances start happening that you're sitting there thinking, this is absurd. Like, things do not happen this way. Like, who thought of this? Who wrote this? This is ridiculous. And as soon as you're about to say something, something's about to come out of your mouth, you look over and your wife is in tears. And you think, what? Like, you're buying this? This is ridiculous. Don't miss it. The drama is planned. It just so happened that a hurricane took our house underwater in New Orleans in 2005. Which just so happened to cause Heather to lose her job teaching in New Orleans and us to be relocated to Atlanta, where I would be teaching seminary via the internet, having a lot more time on the internet to begin searching out possibilities for adoption. And it just so happens that God leads us, of all places, we put a map on the table, and He leads us to Kazakhstan. Like, I didn't know where Kazakhstan was. I didn't even know there was a Kazakhstan. And it just so happens that the place where we've been relocated by this hurricane is just minutes away from an adoption agency that specializes in Kazakhstan. And it just so happens that we put the application in at a certain time and we wait that long process that so many are familiar with. You're thinking, why is this taking so long? And it just so happens that at one point, everything comes together for a child in an obscure city in northwestern Kazakhstan to be adopted. And it just so happens that we get that call and we find ourselves flying over into this obscure city in Kazakhstan. And it makes the hundreds of orphans in that one city. It just so happens that we find ourselves holding our son Caleb in His arms. God's planning the drama for good, for His glory. He's behind the details. Behold, Boaz comes at that time, came from Bethlehem. He said to the reapers, "The Lord be with you." And they answered, "The Lord bless you." Oh, He's the knight in shining armor. He's blessing everybody. He is great. It's just who we've been waiting for. And so He says in verse 5, Boaz said to his young man who was in charge of the reapers, "Whose young woman is this?" Check her out. Now notice what He doesn't say. He doesn't say, "Who is that?" He says, "Whose young woman is that? To whom does she belong?" That's the fundamental question in the book. Is this Moabite woman one of us? The family of God? Isn't this the picture of adoption? Isn't it a picture of seeing children who belong to no one? I remember standing in court in Kazakhstan. And the most grueling part of that process for us, that proceeding, was when they laid out the evidence, so to speak, before the judge of how this precious 10-month-old boy had been abandoned at birth and had not been adopted by anyone else in Kazakhstan. No family could be found for him. And no one who wanted him. I mean, they said, "No one here wants him." It's one of those moments where you just want to stand up and scream, "We want him." And the beauty is, Boaz begins to seek the outcast like she's his own family. It says, servant responded, "She is the young Moabite woman who came back with Naomi from the country of Moab. She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves after the reapers. So she came and she has continued from early morning until now, except for a short rest." So here is Boaz seeking after her. Verse 8, Boaz said to Ruth, "Now listen, my daughter. Do not go to glean in another field or leave this one, but keep close to my young women. Let your eyes be on the field that they're reaping and go after them. Have I not charged the young men not to touch you? And when you are thirsty, go to the vessels and drink what the young men have drawn." How's that for an Old Testament pickup line? It lacks a bit of zest, but really it's astounding when you think about it. Israelite man approaching a Moabite woman. A day when obviously many in her situation were mistreated or abused in a field like this. Saying, you can find shelter here. You can find safety here. You can have water here. You can be provided for here. He's not just seeking after her. He's saving her from harm. You know, we as a faith family, as a church, walked through James this last fall. James will mess you up. Because you can't just listen to James. You're like supposed to do it. And so when you get to James 1:27, it says, this is religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless, to look after, to care for, to take responsibility for orphans. And then it continues. And so we called up DHR and our community, the Department of Human Resources in our county, and we said, we know that children obviously need foster care and or adoption in our county due to a variety of different situations in different homes. And we said, do you have any needs when it comes to foster care and adoption? And they laughed. I said, of course we have needs. I said, well, how many families do you need? And they laughed again. They said, more than you can imagine. I said, well, give me a number. Like if there was a miracle, how many families would you need? They said, miracle would be 150 families. We'd be able to take care of all the kids that we have. 150 more families. So I said, okay, we studied James 1, and we said, this is the situation right around us. And we set up an informational meeting 2 weeks later. And God's grace in His people. They show up 2 weeks later, people in her faith family, and 160 families signed up that day to do foster care and adoption, some of whom are at this conference, saying, we want to make sure that every child in our county is cared for and provided for with a loving arm home around them. And that began a process. It's one thing to preach a sermon, but these families have been diving into all the hoops that have to be jumped through and training that is that involved in that. And now the fingerprints have come back, they're beginning to receive children in their homes and these children's needs. This last week, one twin set of 4-month-old kids who have not had any formula since they were born. One's arm is broken, one's leg is broken. Because of abuse. And God has said, these DHR ladies, when we had this meeting, they were tears. They said, one of them pulled me aside. She said, why did you tell your people they needed to do this? And I looked at her and I said, I didn't tell them they needed to do this. God loves these children enough to tell His people that they need to do this. And these people are a reflection of their God. This is the picture. Seeking after, saving from harm. And so the Old Testament pickup line works. Verse 10, she fell on her face, bowing down to the ground. If that's the result, then something is good here. Why have I found favor in your eyes that you should take notice of me since I'm a foreigner? You know, that seems almost a little overreaction, overdramatic, but the reality is, readers who heard this know that this is Ruth honoring the one who has sought after her and protected her. And so, in verse 11, Boaz answered her, all that you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband has been fully told to me, how you have left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. The Lord repay you for what you have done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord. I love this phrase. It's strong, really strong in the original language. The God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. She said, I have found favor. That points us back to the beginning. I'm looking for someone who will show me favor. I have found favor in your eyes, my Lord, for you have comforted me and spoken kindly to your servant, though I am not one of your servants. Basically, Ruth saying, I'm on the lowest rung of the social ladder, and you have comforted my spirit, stirred my soul with your kindness. Now it gets really good. Verse 14. And at mealtime, Boaz said to her, come here and eat some bread and dip your morsel in the wine. So she sat beside the reapers, and he passed to her roasted grain. And she ate until she was satisfied, and she had some left over. Oh yeah, first date in the book of Ruth. Romantic meal over roasted grain. More than just a meal, a symbol, a picture. He's not just giving her food, he is serving her. He's saying to a Moabite woman, come to my table, and here is some bread, here is some vinegar. I'm serving you. You know the picture I've got in my mind? Have you ever been to a macaroni grill? That's the picture I've got. Your macaroni grill, abundant bread with vinegar, oil, pepper mixture. That, here's the key. You can take the kids, take the wife and kids, guys, to macaroni grill. If you sit outside, that way they can make as much noise as they can because it's kind of a nice restaurant. You sit outside and you and your wife split a meal for the kids, and then fill the rest of the family up on bread and water. You can get out of there for less than $20. Radical macaroni grill. Like, it's great. And so here's the picture. You've got Boaz serving Ruth at his table. And here we're seeing, now here's horizontal relationship of reflective of a vertical reality. Here's a woman who is provided for. Why? Because God has set up a way for her to be provided for in among the people of Israel. And Boaz is a reflection here of the love of God. And this is what we see all throughout the Old Testament. God intends his people to be a reflection of his care for those who are in need. God has ordained his people to be a reflection for his care for those who are in need. We just heard about it in the Psalms. God delights in showing his power to the powerless. And showing his greatness by helping the weak and the oppressed and the hurting. And he has always ordained his people to be a reflection of that facet of his character. It's why James 1:27 says what it says. It's why James 2 says, what good is it if you claim to have faith in God, but you have no deeds? If you say to your brother or sister, go, I wish you well, keep warm and well fed, but you do nothing about his physical needs, what good is that? Your faith in God is no faith at all. We do need to hear that word in our day. In a room even this morning that is filled with hundreds of millions of dollars. In our churches, in our lives, in homes and cars and clothes and stuff, we are all extremely wealthy. No, you may not always feel wealthy. We had a roof over our head last night. I have no worries about water or food. We have clothes to keep us warm. This separates us out from most of the world. And we live in a culture that we know where success is defined by getting more. And the more successful you are, the more stuff you have, and the bigger house, and the nicer car, and the better things. And we fill our lives, and we bring this into the church. You want to know how you can tell what a successful church is? Look how many millions they've spent on themselves, and how much they're spending on catering programs to themselves, how much we're spending on our comforts and our luxury. There's a great, big, growing church. This is not New Testament religion that we've created. And this is the whole point of New Testament religion. The more you grow in God, the more you give yourself for the sake of those who are in need. That's the picture we see, Old Testament, New Testament alike. I shared a little bit in chapel here on Thursday. I hate budget season as a pastor, because it's where we as a church come face to face with how little we believe the gospel, with the way we spend. And so, we were studying James, and James is not a good book to study when you're looking at the budget. And so, we said, what are we doing? If there are 26,000 children who will die today of starvation or a preventable disease, then we've got to spend our resources differently. We've got to. I've got to in my own life. We've got to as Christians, and we have to as a church. And so we began looking for ways to cut our budget everywhere we could, to free up as much as we could. I shared in chapel that we do so much stuff. Our worship ministry, we have so much fluff. We just cut 83% of the worship budget. But gone. Do we need to see a stage, or do we need to feed those who are starving and share the gospel with them in the process? So we took trash from the dumpsters in Birmingham. We built a slum on our stage so that we can be reminded week in and week out that the world does not look like Birmingham, Alabama. And we went through, everybody, it's like competition. Who can cut more? And the preschool ladies were like, just little things. Our children, they go to abundant lunches every day on every Sunday. So why do we give them all this assortment of snacks? This is ridiculous. So a couple weeks later, my son comes home and I say, how did church go today, buddy? And he said, Daddy, we didn't have goldfish today. My wife's sitting there and she says, that's your daddy's fault, Caleb. We began to fix our eyes toward India. Fix our eyes toward inner city Birmingham and India. India in particular, 41% of the world's poor in one country alone. And we had, this in and of itself is evidence of God's grace, particularly in our economic climate. But we had been conserving our spending. Our financial guys have been saying, all right, let's keep a tight hold on it. And as a result, we'd actually taken in about $500,000 more than we had spent. And our economic guys have been saying, all right, we need to hold on to that for a rainy day. And then we study James, and it's like, what? Like, hold on to it for a rainy day? Our brothers and sisters are in urgent need, so how can we best help them? And we began to explore a partnership. We have done a lot with International Mission Board in India, and we began to explore a partnership along the lines of feeding and caring for those who are poor with Compassion International, and basically found a way that there's some of these villages where we have churches where Compassion International does child sponsorship that starts at age 4 or 5. But in these villages, a lot of kids weren't making it that long. And so they had this way set up where churches can come together and for about $25,000 can provide for a village moms and their kids from prenatal all the way through the first years of birth to get off to a good, healthy start. They do it in conjunction with a local church, very gospel-centered. And so we began praying, okay, well, where can we go in India? And they sent us. And we said, do you have any other need? Which villages, which churches really need help in India? And they sent us 21 of them. And they were all over the country. And so we started praying, all right, which one do we want to adopt? And then we kind of stepped back and we said, well, wait a minute, there's 21 of them, $25,000 each. And it's $525,000, and my God's given us $500,000, so let's take them all. So we called up Compassion and said, we'll take India for $525, please. That's just the beginning. What happens when we unleash the resources God has entrusted to us? Not just in the church, but as Christians. We unleash them as a reflection of the character of God, as a demonstration of the gospel of God. This is the picture. Serving the outcast at his table. And so she eats and she has her fill. This woman who is starving is full. And what happens next? When she rose to glean, verse 15, Boaz instructed his young men, saying, "Let her glean even among the sheaves, and do not reproach her. And also pull out some from the bundles for her, and leave it to her to glean, and do not rebuke her." So Boaz calls his buddies together and says, "I need your help on this one. Let's make sure she's provided for, she is cared for." So verse 17 says, "She gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley." Close to, some estimate 30, some estimate 50 pounds of barley, which translates to about half a month's wages that she just got in one day in the field. She is showered with grace from the Lord of the harvest here. And she goes home with this ephah. This is how we know Ruth's pretty stout. Verse 18, she took it and went into the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She had also brought out and gave her what food she had left over after being satisfied. I love that. Like, she took some bread and from the table and said, "I'm going to put some of this in the pocket and take this home with me." She brings it all back to Naomi. Now Naomi's sitting here. She doesn't know what's happened during the day. Bitter mother-in-law, about to be changed to a very blessed mother-in-law. Her mother-in-law said to her, "Where did you glean today? Where have you worked?" She says the same thing twice. She's bumbling over her words. "What in the world? Where did you go? How did this happen? Blessed is the man who took notice of you." Now, don't miss it here. Obviously, Naomi doesn't know whose field she's been in. And Ruth knows she's been in the field of Boaz, but Ruth doesn't necessarily know the connection between Boaz and Elimelech. And so the drama builds as she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked. And you'll notice the name is left for the last word in the sentence. It's almost like we're looking at Naomi's eyes, just waiting to see her reaction. "The man's name with whom I worked today is Boaz." And this mother-in-law goes absolutely nuts. She said to her daughter-in-law, "May he be blessed by Yahweh the Lord, whose kindness has not forsaken the living or the dead." Naomi said to her, "The man is a close relative of ours, one of our redeemers." Key word in the whole book. He's one of our redeemers. He's one who has the right to make us his own, to bring us into his family. In order to redeem, in order to lay claim to something, to purchase something, you have to have the right to redeem. You've got to have the resources to redeem. You've got to be able to lay claim to purchase that or those. And you've got to have the resolve to redeem. And that's the story that unfolds from this point. Ruth continues to work in the fields of Boaz. Boaz is pretty slow, not catching on to the fact that he needs to be doing something here. And so chapter 3 gives us a story of a pretty shady night at the threshing floor. And that we just won't go into. And we get to chapter 4. And in chapter 4, Boaz takes the initiative. And he steps forward. And we see him as the one who has the right to redeem, the resources to redeem, and the resolve to redeem. Even there, isn't that a great parallel? In order to adopt, you gotta have the right to adopt. You've got to show that you are fit. You know, if you've been through the process, like, you've got to be fingerprinted by every government and civic organization there is. You've got to show that you are the model citizen. You've got to go through this home study, this nerve-wracking home study, which was a problem for us because we didn't have a home. It's underwater. And so we fix up this apartment. And we do our best to try to show, this is a wonderful home. We've been in it for a few days. It's great. Then you've got to get this physical where you've got to be the perfect physical specimen in order to adopt a child. I was nervous about the whole thing. We got there and we were doing the different parts of the physical and we got to the eye exam and we're standing there, Heather and I both, we were doing the eye exam together in the middle of this, what I still maintain was a dark hallway. And at the end, there's that eye chart. And I was up first, and so she says, you know, put your hand over your eye and start to, you know, tell me. And I got like the one at the top, and maybe the ones next, but then I started struggling. I just couldn't make it out. I'm stressing out. I'm starting to sweat. I'm thinking, I'm not going to get to adopt a child because I can't see the F. So I'm getting nervous, and the lady who's doing the eye exam for us, she could tell that I'm really getting flustered, and so she's like, well, why don't you switch the other eye? And so I said, okay, that's a good idea, and I did. The only problem was, in my nervousness, I was pressing my hand down in my eye, and so and everything's blurry. I can't even see the top one now, and I'm struggling, and Heather's like, what's wrong? And so finally she says, why don't you back down, sir? Like, let your wife go, and then you can go. And so I said, okay, that's great. And so I'm over there, like, trying to get my eyes back to normal. And I do that while Heather's doing hers. And so I get my eyes back to normal. And then I decide, okay, this is my chance. So I memorize the chart. I step back up, and I'm like, oh, yeah, E, F, P. Yeah, look, I can do it with both eyes closed. E, F. Check. Got to have the right to redeem. You obviously have to have the resources to redeem. And I am so thankful for brothers and sisters around this room, organizations that are helping provide ways for resources to be available and for helping pull people along in that process. God provides for His purpose to be accomplished. This is important to the heart of God. He will provide. Trust Him. I don't know how. In every circumstance, obviously, but He will provide. We have the resources to redeem, and we have to have the resolve to redeem. You know, you've been through the process. There are points along the way that you wonder, well, should we be doing this? Should we be doing this? Should we be doing this? Is this ever going to happen? Things are not working out the way you planned. Remember, we got to Kazakhstan, and we were in the middle of this freezing city, and sitting in this apartment, and we could visit our son 2 times a day for an hour a time, but he got sick in the middle of that, and so for many days, we just sat in this freezing cold apartment in Kazakhstan. And even there, I was so shocked in my mind, I was thinking, is this really worth it? Like, what? It's tough pressing through, and I remember sitting there one day in one room, and Heather was in the bedroom, and I hear some noise coming from the next room. And it's like shaking the whole apartment. I'm like, what's going on? And she comes out, and she's got her earphones from her iPod in her ears, and she's sweating, and she says, I said, what are you doing? She said, I'm running in place. I said, you're doing what? She says, yeah, well, I figure we can't go outside, so I'm just going to exercise in here and just run in place. And it's one of those moments where I think to myself, this is not what I planned. I'm in the middle of this obscure city in Kazakhstan, and my wife is in the next room running nowhere. It's the resolve pressing through in that process. And that's exactly what happens. Boaz sticks with his resolve, and verse 13 says, chapter 4, verse 13, Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. And he went into her, and the Lord gave her conception. And the barren woman bore a son. The woman said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord who has not left you this day without a redeemer. And may his name be renowned in Israel. He shall be to you a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age. For your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than 7 sons, has given birth to him. And Naomi took the child and laid him on her lap and became his nurse. The women of the neighborhood gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi, the family of Naomi. And they named him Obed. this story began. Two women in need of food, provision, family. And here, a son is in the home. I look at our two sons, in particular Caleb, in light of this picture today, and I thank God for his blessing. The other night, we were getting the boys ready for bed after bath. Caleb had just gotten out of the bath, and I was about to put his clothes on, and there was a ring in the doorbell, and he smiled and looked at me and said, "I'll go get it." I said, "No, you won't. You don't have any clothes on, buddy. You can't go to the door." And so I looked at him and I said, "You stay right here." He smiled. I said, "Buddy, stay right here." And so I leave the room and I go get the door, and I open it, and it's two Mormon girls. And, I don't have time to invite them in and have a discussion about a false gospel. And so I'm trying to think of what kind of one-liner could I use that would, like, be compassionate but a good solid jab at false teaching. And so I'm running through my mind how I can do this, and at that moment I look at their face, and all of a sudden their eyes just go wide. And I realize what has happened. I turn around, and behind me, my son, with absolutely nothing on, is dancing around in a circle, waving to these ladies, like, "My son mooned the Mormons." I couldn't have thought of something that good. Oh, what delight, not just in that, but in the blessing of God. In the blessing of God. And you know, it's really interesting. The whole point of the book flows in this next phrase. They named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. And this is where this story ratchets up to a whole other level. Because it's not just a story about a Moabite woman being brought to an Israelite man. It's a story about God sovereignly working by his grace to preserve a line that will lead to a king. And not just King David. Because you get to Matthew chapter 1, verse 5. And there, in the most unlikely of places, in the lineage of Jesus Christ himself, you see the name of Ruth. What in the world is a Moabite woman from a despised and forbidden people doing in that family line? Brothers and sisters, she is there for the same reason we are there. Not because we have earned it or merited it. Brothers and sisters, we are Ruth. Wandering and working in the field with absolutely nothing to draw anyone to us. Deserving of nothing. And the Lord of the harvest has sought after you. He has pursued you. He has called you by name. He sought after you as his own family. He has stooped to save you from harm. In his pursuit of you, he has protected you from the payment of your sin. He has invited you and me, the God of the universe, the Lord of the harvest, has invited you and me to his table to be served by him. Served. Mark 10:45. To be showered by his grace because he alone has the right to redeem us. Jesus is near to us, like us in every way, yet without sin. And he has the resources to redeem. He has divine authority over sin and death itself. And he, praise God, he has the resolve to redeem. And he has pursued you and taken up a cross, not because he had to, but because he loved obedience to the Father more than his own life. And not just taken up a wooden cross, he has taken your sin and my sin and put it upon himself and made a way for you and I to be called sons and daughters of the living God. Hallelujah. That's the gospel, and it is at the core of the picture of Ruth and the core of the picture this weekend. Close with this. We went to Kazakhstan. We get off the plane in Caleb's city and we're greeted by our interpreter there. We get in the car to drive to where we were going to be staying for the next month. And she says, "What do you do?" I said, "I'm a preacher." She said, "Oh, you are Christians?" I said, "Yes." And she said, "You are weak. It's nice to meet you. What was your name again?" She said, "All Christians are weak. You can't make it on your own, so you have to have a crutch." And this is what she's saying in the car, initial conversation. You need a crutch. So that's why you go to God and Christianity. And that began a process where over the next month we had conversation after conversation after conversation with our interpreter. And we shared with her that she was exactly right. We are weak. And we are desperately in need of a God who has shown great love to us. We said to this woman who hosts couples in adoption all the time, the reason we're adopting is because we're weak. And because we need a God who loves us. And he has loved us. And that drives us to this place. For this child. And she listened and she listened and she listened. And the last night we were about to walk out on the tarmac at the airport. And she said, "I need to tell you something." And she pulls me aside. And she said, "I just want you to know that last night I asked Jesus to save me from my sins. And I confessed my need for him." And we walk out on the tarmac with this son that we have adopted in our arms, looking back at the daughter he had adopted in his arms. God, we pray that you would help us to be a clear reflection of the gospel that has saved us. We pray that horizontal love flowing in our lives would pour out of the spring of vertical love you have shown to us. All glory be to your name. Amen.